10? Okay, that was good enough for me. Josh said yes. Assuming it, can all members of the public see and hear? Nobody is from the public? Okay, Lisa, do you want to read your little line?
I do want to read my line. This meeting is being recorded. Once President Brooks asked me to call the roll, indicate you are here as well as give permission to record by verbally stating here, permission to record.
Okay, I call the November 4th, 2020 Committee of the Whole meeting of the Glencoe Park District to order. Lisa, please call the roll and note the time.
Okay, 7:08. Member Boren?
Here, permission to report.
Member Hovey? Absent at this time. Member Ludden?
Here, permission to report.
Member Underdunk?
I'm here and permission to record.
Chair Brooks?
Here, permission to record.
Excellent.
Sorry, I was texting Michael. Sorry. Okay, so it is our practice not to address questions at this time. However, we will take comments under advisement. Is there anyone who would like to make a verbal comment? If so, please limit comments to 3 minutes per person. Is anyone else on? Any members of public?
I don't see any members. It's just staff, looks like.
Okay, very good. So we will move to the first bit of business. Lisa Shepherd and Carol will lead the discussion on our preliminary discussion of fiscal year 2021-2022 budget.
Okay, I'm going to try this. Can you see the screen I'm sharing or not?
Not yet.
No.
All right. A second. All right. Put that in here. Mm-hmm. I don't really need to share this, but I was just going to try to. Let's see if I can do it again. There we go. All right. So what we really want to accomplish at tonight's committee meeting is, with COVID-19 and really turning our budget on end and the continued ramifications, we thought it best to start discussions on next year's budget and some assumptions, just to kind of get your thoughts before we go through all the work of developing our whole budget and then bring it to the end, and it's not what you all are thinking. So we have a few policy and funding questions that we're going to go over with you. So the first one is categories of service. So we are required yearly, based on the policy, on this policy, to review this with the board yearly, discuss any changes, different philosophies that you would like to establish. So it was included in your board packet. I just want to note a few changes that were put into effect because of COVID. So I guess we need to know if you would like to continue with those changes for next year. And one would be continue if COVID restrictions are still in place. And the second would be whether to continue if COVID restrictions are no longer in place. So one of the changes is that we applied non-resident fees for Watts, so that's this season right now. So we are planning on, we did charge non-resident fees for gaming passes and classes and such this year. We also did 100% increase for resident rates for season passes for non-residents. That was another change we did. And then the other change is we eliminated any discounts to other entities for the beach passes, and actually for staff passes also. That's a different policy. So in the past, we've given full-time Village of Glencoe, Glencoe Library District, 35 staff, a Glencoe beach pass, individual beach pass for no fee. So any changes, questions on this policy that we'd like to change?
I have a quick question. A 9.0 discounts to other entities, that was prior to COVID. So that was not a COVID-related change. That was something we discussed before COVID was on the radar.
No, actually, we had the discount. we were still giving the discount for full-time village. We did not remove it.
But but sure not the school district. What was the date of that we made that decision?
That was we reviewed this last June, and no changes were made. But you're right, we said at the time they discussed whether we should look at that for next year, so that would be this coming summer. It was discussed whether we should take that out, but last year we did not remove it. When we were discussing in June.
Decision, I would like to go back and read that, because I'm in my brain, and I'm sure I'm wrong, but I was sure we just discussed it and decided that that was not necessary. The beach pass situation for the school district, since it's such a large employer, and then there was a subsequent discussion where there wasn't a lot of, we didn't get a lot of negative feedback after we enacted it. Did I dream this?
No, we discussed it, that there was the board didn't do any change, and I remember the discussion, and no change was made, and it was said to bring back for this year to discuss if we'd like to remove it. Then we did remove it for last summer because of COVID, because we knew that season passes would be limited. The board would like to change that policy going forward, that's what we're here to discuss tonight.
What I remember is that we said we would use this summer as a test and see how many times they're used. Obviously, we couldn't do that. So that's my recollection, that we wanted to see, is someone using it 15 times, or is a staff member, barely using it? So obviously, we didn't get our test case.
We did not. Usually, what we see in the past, and Bobby probably can chime in on this, is usually what happens with school district employees or village employees or library, for example, is that they usually use that pass to go down during their lunch hour to just eat lunch down there, hang out. You don't see them coming back a lot on the weekends. They obviously, especially school teachers, that they don't really driven to go hang out with their students on the summer when they're down there. So you see them more as if they do a walk down there before work, after work, and during their day, so.
But we really weren't collecting that kind of data in the past, were we?
We did not collect it. We were going to collect it this year, but.
We presented it to the board over a year ago in the beach report, and it was minimal. It was about a dozen employees throughout the village, and it was probably half the school district, so I think six from the school district, two or three from the library, one or two from the village. And it was so minimal at the time. I think it was, a couple of dozen visits.
Mm-hmm. So does anyone have a recommendation then, whether we shall continue this or go back to handing out the passes? Stephanie, do you have a thoughts on that?
Knowing that the numbers aren't that high, and I probably feel differently than I did the last time we had this discussion, so I think then I was more against it. I think it's probably okay. Obviously, with COVID and restrictions, we wouldn't do it because we're limiting the amount of people, and we won't show favoritism to anyone by giving passes. But I think in a normal season, it's okay.
Josh?
I feel the same way Stephanie does.
Okay, Dudley?
Clarification. So this past year, it was not used at all because of COVID. Is that correct?
Correct. We did not offer that benefit.
Did not offer it. Does this present any challenges for us in administration for next year as we go to a slightly different registration program?
No, there'd be no administrative issues to do this if we chose to do it.
Okay, well, I'm okay with it then.
And what I would recommend is that we keep the policy the way it is, and then just know that, if that's what the board wants, just know that if we have COVID restrictions, the amount of passes we sell, then we would not offer that benefit again this year.
Okay.
But we wouldn't have to make a policy change. Okay.
And I will say, I think that when we stopped the free passes, we did didn't receive a lot of negative feedback, so I don't think it's a benefit that people will consider a great loss. I think it creates potential issues if we are having limited sales, and now we've also gone out into the public. I don't know how many employees are we talking about here?
I actually have documents for me to tell you what they are.
Is it, I mean, just a general, is it hundreds?
There was 4 from the library, 8 from the school district, 1 from the village, 1 from family services, for a total of 16 visits at 2 summers ago.
No, I'm asking how many employees would we be offering free passes to?
Well, I think it was probably about 200, but only a very small minority have ever taken us up on it. So okay. It's kind of nice goodwill gesture. The school district
is the theory, so that's just what but you know, I'm outnumbered anyway, so.
Okay.
So there you have your answer, correct?
Yes, I do. Do we want to keep 100% more for restaurants for season passes at the beach? That's what we did this year. In the past, it's 50%.
Now, that is the maximum amount we're allowed under the
program. Correct. Yeah, we can't do any more than that. Correct.
Yes.
Can I interrupt just for a second? Jenny, can you resend Zoom to Michael?
Sure.
Everyone's using their... So if you could, that's great.
Here it comes.
Is Michael, are you in?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Okay.
Do we have permission to record?
Yes, you do.
Thank you. Okay.
So, Michael, we're discussing 6.0 on page, I can't even see what page it is.
Page 2 of 4.
Okay, 2 of 4. Lisa, just go ahead and repeat what your
okay, so our question is do we want to keep, this year we changed the season pass rates for the beach from 50% more for non-residents to 100% more for non-residents. Do you want to continue that for next year?
I don't think we have to make that decision now. Can we, this is one of the questions I was asking you, are these guardrails, or are these like set in stone, it's what it's going to be?
These ones right here are policies that we set, and the fees for other programs are not, the exact fees are guidelines for them. So the board sets the limits and parameters, and then the staff sets the fees for the classes. But historically, the board has set what the differential between non-resident and residents are for the beach.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit too early in November to make that kind of decision. I think we should have the flexibility to say, you know, you can go as high as 100%. I think it's early to state that, but I'm fine going to 100% if that's what we want to do. But I thought these were, like 6.1, I thought was like, hey, what, we're coming, I'm trying to figure out how to put my video on. Sorry, I thought 6.1 was to say, like, hey, you can go from here to there, and then staff can sort of decide. But I'm fine with 100%. I just didn't think that was decided tonight or at the next board meeting.
We don't have to decide tonight. We can decide next month if you'd like to hold that. But we need it for budget planning purposes. And over, we can say we keep it at 50% of resident rate, unless we're in the same position as we were this year with COVID, and then we keep it 100%.
I'm fine at 100% for my vote, just because it's so expensive to run, and we have so many repairs that we have to do in the next 2 to 3 years alone, so.
I'm fine with 100%, I'm fine with up to 100%, I just don't know why we have to decide now, but look, this is not. Sure. I mean, we can do up to 100% if we want to. If we want to come down lower, we have the ability as a board to decide that later, I presume.
Well, it's just setting guidelines for our budget, so it's hard to, we could do it, but it would affect the budget that you're going to approve later on. But with that, further down.
No, so, I understand, but the budget, look, the budget is out there for a reason. It's to help, the budget itself is guidelines. We don't know what revenue is going to be. I'm fine with it at 100% if that's what, if we have to decide now, I'm okay with that, knowing that, you know, if we want to move it down later, we can move it down later and have a budget issue with it.
Josh?
I'm fine with it as proposed.
Dudley?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I'm good.
And yeah, I'm fine with it 100%.
Okay.
No pun intended, Lisa Brooks.
The other, Michael, we already discussed discounts to other entities for the Glencoe Beach will remain.
Yep.
Unless it's we're in COVID again and we have to limit beach pass sales, then we would remove that as benefits.
Yep.
All right, and then the next one is for consideration is just our categories of service. We set, these are where we set perimeters and just know that in some of these areas we haven't gotten to those exact percentages yet, but these are our goals to cover our direct and indirect expenses. Any changes on this chart?
This was a carryover from last year?
This is in our policy, yes. We have to, per our policy, review it yearly before we start the budget process so staff has direction.
I'm personally fine with what was in place last year.
I see no reason to change this.
Okay. Stephanie?
Just hello, so someone else can block.
Sorry, Lisa Shepherd, one quick question on this.
Absolutely.
Did we meet the, for the parks and playgrounds, did we meet the 90% from Children's Circle this year?
To cover the direct and indirect?
Yeah.
Expenses of that?
Well, we're in the middle of the fiscal year, so it's kind of hard to tell. Given the operations so far, I would say the estimate would be yes, especially given the grants that have been received.
Okay.
Well, we budgeted to cover it.
Yes, we have budgeted to cover it.
So we built a price for the program around this assumption.
I'm fine with it. Okay.
Me too. Okay. I'm fine with it. We really discussed this a lot last year.
We did, yeah. Okay. All right. We'll go with that perspective. Thank you very much for your input. All right. Next, we're going to move to levels of service offered by parks and facilities. Maintenance, I'm going to turn it over to Chris to discuss this and answer any questions you may have on this.
I know it's a lot to unload. I'll apologize first of all. My webcam is on my small monitor, and it's hard to read this unless it's on my big monitor. So if I look away, I'm not trying to be rude. As we previously discussed, we did make some cuts to the parks budget this year, just around the COVID revenues, loss of revenue, and we saw what we could operate as far as a essential department versus the areas that we started to get pressure on once we cut back. So some of the areas we cut back a little bit in the beginning was athletic field maintenance, conservation maintenance, and a few other small capital items that we felt we could put off to another year. So just for the purposes of this discussion, I kind of define what the essential baseline for operating the department is, what the operation of this department looks like every day for us to continue to provide the same base levels of service to this community that they desire. Things that don't really fit inside that, essential operating framework is, bringing our athletic fields above that recreational level, bringing up conservation maintenance to a new level in the park district, things like additional herbicide applications to the greenways along Old Green Bay Road, burn-in, in addition, requests for additional park mowings just based on the rainy season, things of that nature. So, Lisa, if you want to just scroll down for me, thanks. So what I alluded to is there's a couple of areas where, up a little bit, please, where we're fielding, some resident concerns, complaints, just an overall sense that, you know, hey, the Park District could be doing more, they should be doing more. First and foremost, we see that in athletic fields. You know, we are investing money there in capital, but on the operating side, we're just not able to keep those fields to the same level that they are the day that they open. The example that I gave was Berlin Field. That field, you know, gets a tremendous amount of use. We do really great maintenance on it at the recreation level, but it certainly doesn't look like the day it did when it opened. So you can just kind of see the ballparks of what we're spending on supplies for athletic fields. I mean, this obviously doesn't cover the hundreds of staff hours. That's more difficult to bullet point out, but you can just kind of see the breakdown in the regular operating budget. The other area that I'm getting feedback on, and, you know, and when I say feedback, some come as complaints, some come as questions, some come as ideas for new initiatives. I mean, the majority of these interactions are about education. They're not, you know, people calling up on a Monday morning and complaining to the park district that we're wasting their tax money or we should do better. They're generally framed in a pretty positive light. The other area is conservation. You know, we have nearly 100 acres of open space, and we have significant invasive plant species throughout those areas. Right now, cost-effectively, the best maintenance that we can do is with a lawnmower. We've got natural areas right now that really don't meet industry standards that we're trying to get up, but we've heard a lot of feedback on that. So, Lisa, if you just want to scroll down. I use the academic average, you know, for field maintenance of being at a C plus, B minus, and there's a resident desire for it to be at an A minus, A plus type level. So in addition, we also have the Green Bay Trail project that's opening next year and the Duke Park project. So those, you know, as we've talked about in the past, are going to require additional resources to maintain them at a functional level, which we know. So we'll likely have to move our resources around a little bit in that particular regard. But when it comes to athletic fields, I mean, we're talking about Glencoe Youth Baseball, which represents about 300 resident households, which is 10% of all the households in Glencoe. Conservation, on the other hand, impacts really all of our park users. Although there is different levels of education there, you know, some folks are on the green is good train where other residents are asking new questions, things about sustainable water management, rewilding of parks, recycling, you know, all types of scenarios in that. So I brought a few solutions to the board to just have a dialogue about, just because, you know, we have this baseline that we're providing to the community, and we're hearing from a couple of groups that, you know, we'd like to look at that baseline, and I just wanted to get the board's thoughts on that.
I can't see everybody's face. I apologize. Somebody else was talking. Go ahead.
Okay.
Lisa, could I start?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, this is Dudley. The youth baseball, you're giving the rating for the, this is the overall rating for the play fields, C plus, B minus, is that right?
Yes.
Yes. What would it take to bring it up to a solid B?
That's a great question. Money. I mean, that's the challenge is, you know, we have a fixed amount of labor, and the resources that we need to, there involves, you know, just contractual hours or just rethinking how we're doing baseball fields in general. That's one of the things that I'd like to talk about the board with, as far as, you know, what our operation looks like, what operational efficiency looks like, what we're seeing other districts in similar situations to us doing in the same situation. So it really comes down to either operating dollars or capital dollars effectively.
Well, as we look at the budget for next year, how will we get an idea of, I mean, are we talking 10% increase or, you know, 30% increase, just to bump it up a little bit? I don't think it's realistic for a community park system to be maintained at A level in all areas.
So, Chris, do you have an estimate, or is that something you'd bring back to the board?
I think it's something I would bring back to the board. I think we would have to set goals. I mean, if the board was willing to have that dialogue about, you know, using those additional resources, knowing that that would mean that they're likely not there for fund transfers to capital in the future.
That's what it means. And there's also other things we can look at. So there's, we can look at one approach. One approach would be to increase our staffing, whether they're direct employees or they would be contracted out, right? And to improve the amount of times we get on the fields, to improve the maintenance, to improve spring setup and field maintenance, and then daily field maintenance. Another way to look at it is should we investigate looking at artificial infield turf that would be less maintenance, but it's a capital investment. And is that something the board would want to look at? And then maybe look at baseball, maybe going back to baseball and saying if you would like this level of service that, you know, such as an infield turf that you could use more year-round, I guess not year-round, but more during the rating season, things like that, that the board would say, you would have to help us do that capital investment, whether it would be 50-50 or something like that, if that's something you wanted to explore.
That I think you touched on. We're starting to see a lot of communities doing that now with the rainy springs that we're having is, you know, maybe 10 years ago, you would go to an athletic turf and you'd see the whole field done in turf, and you know that was a $1 million project. Now we're starting to see a lot more infields only, and that, like Lisa said, gives you that flexibility to play in the rain or to play on a soggy day. You know, for some of our programs, you know, we have participants that really aren't even hitting it out of the infield. So those particular types of projects can cost between about $180,000 and $200,000. With a lifespan of, you know, 10 to 12 years on the actual playing surface. So when you look at our fields in general, I mean, if our four athletic fields, if we were to build them today, they would probably cost us about $3 to $3.5 million. So, I mean, if we're investing, you know, $50,000 a year in our operating budget, it's less than 1% of the replacement cost of those fields for maintenance every single year. So I think that we've also not had a continuity in the level of resources available. We've had some years where we surged and we spent money, and then other years where we cut back and we just did operational maintenance as well.
So the baseball meeting we had about a year ago, that was more based on expectations versus resources.
Correct.
Now you're saying more it's money. So that's why I want to get like the difference between, we also talked about at that meeting, putting some, like, you know, let's say 50,000 in each year, and we did talk about that, and I know when we got to the budget, we never really went for it. We also talked about baseball contributing to that. I don't know where we're at with them. I don't feel like we ever had like another meeting. I'm sure you've had conversations. I don't think the board has. And then there's one more thing. Oh, also during that time, we talked about a turf field at Takis. And I remember there was someone else involved with that. I'm not recalling the details. I know it was a donor you talked to. Do you recall that and whatever happened with that?
Yeah, we do not have a donor that is committed to doing that, but we have individuals that said they would work with baseball to try to see if there would be interest in doing that. But there's no guarantee with that. We've had, Chris and Bobby have done a great job developing an excellent relationship with youth baseball board. They're actually a wonderful board to work with, and they understand the limitations of the park district. And I know they field a lot of those questions too. And they understand that we have limited budgets to allocate to that. And as I'm sure you saw in the board packet, when you look at Fund 65, we did allocate $50,000 to youth baseball fields. Recommending for this year to start doing some of those improvements. Probably take way more than that to really get them up to a B, to be honest with you. So that, just some of the things. Does that answer your question, Chris or Bobby? Do you have anything to add to that?
Lisa, I think you touched on it first. Commissioner Boron, the conversation with baseball before really was focused on managing expectations that we don't have five staff to come running out of the dugout after the rain breaks on a Saturday at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And it was really more centered on what was necessary for operational play. And that was the perception that the park district was throwing in the towel after we got 2 inches of rain instead of sending staff out there and even at the old college trying to get folks out on the field. So I think we rectified that in a couple of ways. You know, we've made an effort, and GBA has done an amazing job communicating priorities. I mean, the credit really goes to Brad Friedman, who is unbelievably organized and diligent in communicating with the park district and saying this is a playoff game versus this is a scrimmage. So I think by GBA taking onus over what's most important to them, we moved away from a position of being told prep every field every day and having staff come in the morning and they didn't play there. So I we've had a major improvement in that area. I think that this is more related to the actual aesthetic condition of the field, not the like the level of support on game day. I mean, Bobby, would you say that that's a fair assessment? You're muted.
Yeah, absolutely. I've had multiple discussions with GBA over capital contributions. I have a meeting on Friday with them to kind of recap the season, which I'm going to bring it up again. From a financial point of view, I think to them, you know, giving the park district $5,000 to $10,000 is a huge amount of money to them when the fields are going to take a lot more money than that to get to the expectation of a lot of residents. They are very willing to help. They are just getting to the point where they're financially, they know where they are financially. So Brad is kind of his second year. So he understands that we've started going in that direction and they need to kind of step up to the plate a little bit here too.
I have a question. I can't see it because you scroll up a little bit. Chris, I understand you made a comment about that. That's it, great. $27,000 for total athletic, well, you know, and you concurred that, of course, that barely acknowledges the amount that we're spending because, of course, most of the money is in staff charges. So that makes it a little difficult for me to wrap my head around, well, what are we talking about here and so forth. I will also say I love the idea of doing an artificial turf infield because, wow, then we'll stop getting complaints about condition. I don't think we will stop getting complaints, but it might have some impact. But it would be very difficult to sell that to the community after we have that $1 million field put in 5 years ago. Even if it feels like that would be a good solution now, I think that would be difficult to justify. And I also think, you know, we're in this challenging budget time, and to you know, to look at capital dollars going in or like whole new programs, and it feels like we talked about this before, you know, that we had the Cubs people come in and give us some, you know, pointers on how to do the field, and then we had this horribly rainy season. So, which, you know, may happen every year, and it may not happen again for several years. So I'm just having a hard time getting my hands around exactly what it is we would need to consider doing in order to bring it up to what I thought Dudley very, very reasonably stated was a B-level field.
I think if we are okay with it being a B-level field, I think that's very different than the comparisons that we're getting to the neighboring communities for synthetic turf fields and fields that have dedicated maintenance staff. I mean, because we're at that C+, B- average. I mean, saying that I want to go from a field that's rated at 78% to 85%, that's not a major shift in the operating budget. That's, you know, maybe doing a little more resodding in the spring or something like that. I don't honestly think that that's going to meet the expectations of those groups. So I think if that's the flavor of kind of the way we want to take it, that's something that can be accomplished without, you know, major changes in our budget. But I still think that that's going to put us in the same boat of fields that just don't meet the expectations of the users.
But maybe that's something that has always been the case and will always be the case. Because I've been listening to this since I started 6 years ago, and I mean to tell you, it's a chronic problem with expectations, specifically in this sport. Expectations not being met, and I know part of the problem is they are looking at fields that are very different from us, very different communities, and expecting our fields to mimic those. And of course, there's many, many reasons why they don't. So I do think managing expectations, which Stephanie, that meeting we had, I only listened into it because I was someplace, I don't know where I was, but I listened into the meeting, and you're right, it was, I thought, a very productive meeting. I was really very optimistic about working with GBA, with the people that are in charge now, and how they're going to contribute and partner with us to manage expectations of some of those loud voices on the sidelines that, sometimes they just don't understand. So, I mean...
And to be honest, they have. GBA has made a huge improvement over the last 2 years managing their players' expectations. They really have. They've been great partners with this new board. Has been amazing. But then there's still those expectations, still those people on the sidelines. And if our board says, no, we're okay if these are recreation fields and the amount of money we allocate to field maintenance and to getting the fields ready for games, that's what we're going to do, then that's great. We just want direction to make sure that's actually a board directive, that's the level of service we want to provide to youth baseball. And that's what we'll tell them.
May I add a few cents here?
Yes.
First, I think that given all the uncertainty that we had about whether we were going to be able to play group sports at all in the spring, being cautious about how much we invested in preparatory maintenance this year was a wise move. One that I think is easy to defend. Having my kids are just a few years removed from playing GBA and baseball in other places, and I certainly can identify that there are a handful of fields in neighboring communities that are maintained at an extremely high level. But I would point out that is far from every baseball field in our neighboring communities. It might be true that there are youth baseball players and families who are at maybe the higher end of commitment or ability or whatever that are doing travel baseball as well as GBA that have an expectation that that's what they would like to play on. But I'm not sure that that serves the majority of the kids who are more at a recreational level. I guess that I would just put that out there, that not every field has to be a professionally, A-level field. I'm not an expert at baseball fields, but I've seen a lot of youth baseball fields in rural areas, in suburban areas, and ours are pretty dang nice compared to some that I've seen. Chris, your evaluation of them as C+, B- may well be fair, but maybe I've seen a lot of D's. I guess the last thing I would say is if GBA or others are unsatisfied with the level of maintenance, we could certainly ask them to contribute more in return for a higher level of maintenance. If they or others felt like we really needed an A-level field, then I'd say, well, then we need a major financial commitment. The board needs to completely change its point of view about what the priorities of the community are. But right now, I don't see the board saying, geez, let's spend $1 million on a grade A field.
Okay. Thank you, Jeff. Michael?
I think I'm the only parent here who has a kid in GBA.
Currently.
And I will say that Josh Lutton summed it up perfectly.
Yeah, I would say
speak on the I will not speak on the matter.
Okay. Can I give you what you need, Lisa? Chris?
I really appreciate the clear direction. I think that that's A-okay in my book. So thank you for that.
And by the way, can I just add, I know how stressful it is to receive complaints, especially complaints that are real. There's a lot of passion behind them. I know that it's a time suck and an energy suck and a morale suck, and I acknowledge that. What to do about it, but I acknowledge that it takes its toll on the people receiving the complaints, and I'm sorry.
Thank you. You know, and there's never enough hands in the Parks Department in April and May to go around, and, you know, it's just trying to figure out how to keep all those balls in the air, and I think, you know, with some small improvements here and there, we can make the difference at the recreational level, so... I did want to touch on conservation, Lisa, if you want to just scroll back up.
Scroll back up or down?
Up, please.
Okay.
So another one of the areas that we're continually getting feedback on is conservation, whether that's natural area maintenance, stormwater maintenance, herbicide use, just recycling, just the general concept of it. In the last 4 years, we have significantly moved up what we are spending on conservation. This number that you see here of $45,000 is a budgeted number. It's not what we spent this year. We did suspend the Everly Deet stewardship contract because of COVID. We did go ahead with the bioswale stewardship here at SOSA and then at Thakif, and then, of course, our SOSA partnership at Shelton Park. So the reason for this dialogue is we're hearing a lot about increasing the footprint of our natural areas when that is connected to significantly increased costs in operational maintenance. So I just wanted to have a little bit of dialogue on, you know, what that priority should be, if we should continue to grow those service contracts. We're at a point where it is likely that we'll be bundling all of our contracts together into one contract this year, just the way that they're all expiring. But I wanted to get some board feedback on that as well.
So could you give a little explanation of the difference of price? You did a really good job.
Sure. So I'll give a breakdown. You know, we had run the numbers a while back, and we were looking at 2 cents a square foot to cut grass for the season, and about 6 cents a square foot, 8 cents a square foot. I take that back. 16 cents a square foot to manage natural areas. And when I say a natural area, I want to separate out tree maintenance, those kinds of things, because that's already a well-established practice. I'm talking about areas like the Bob Everly Sanctuary, the Clara Deet Sanctuary. We have a prairie area in Shelton Park and a number of other prairie pods that just really aren't getting the attention that they need. In addition, at Shelton, Cauk, and a few other parks, we have some volunteer-driven planting areas that are more formal gardens than they are natural areas, and they've really been left to atrophy as those volunteers moved on to bigger and better things or moved out of the community, passed away, whatever. So that really kind of breaks up those three areas. So conservation maintenance is a little different than just general landscaping. You're bringing somebody in who's skilled and knowledgeable on what an invasive plant species is. They use the proper herbicide to treat that. It's removed. Usually you're bringing that company in for what they call stewardship visits. So it might be between 5 and 8 visits, 10 visits a year. It could have a controlled burn with it on the number of on a bi-yearly cycle. We've been very successful at the Everly Sanctuary with natural area maintenance. And so as we've raised the standard there at that particular area, I think some of our other sites are now starting to really show that, you know, one, we don't have a stewardship contract there, or stewardship really is just kind of on a 5-alarm fire basis, that kind of thing. We also added the Thakif Bioswales 3-4 years ago, and those are running us about $10,000 a year in stewardship maintenance as well to function properly. So did that explain my...
Yeah, So what we do is sometimes we get comments that they want more natural areas with the assumption, I think a lot of people's assumption is that you just throw what seeds in there and you're good to go and you don't have to worry about it. It's a lot cheaper than maintenance of like natural turf.
Which it absolutely is on the side of a highway.
Yeah.
And I think that there is a lot of very successful campaigns to rewild low quality green areas that were planted with turf grass just because that's what we had in the bag. But I think that when you move them into a high impact park system, there has to come maintenance costs along with that to maintain, you know, the appropriate natural area.
So we're adding some natural area to the trail, if I remember correctly, unless you cut that out.
It's a very small area.
Very small area. Well, it will be negligible in the scope of what we're talking about here today.
So,
decorative plantings.
I mean, not like, obviously this is always a good idea and, you know, something that the community would definitely support, just that we still don't know how long we're going to be kind of in this COVID shutdown kind, you know, where we're just not bringing in as much money. So this seems, to me, this seems like a little bit of a luxury right now.
Okay.
Dudley?
Well, one of the issues we're facing is that we're getting lots of what they call ecosystem services out of these bioswales that are hard to quantify, but we're managing stormwater runoff, which is really a big deal. And so you do get a lot of, I'll call them off the book services when we have this. With respect to the bioswales stewardship, perhaps with additional education, some of our own staff can do some work in that area. That would be one thing that we could look into. I'd like us to maintain the level that we have. Doesn't need to increase particularly, but I think the part of what the benefit we also get from the bioswales and other conservation stewardship is a demonstration to other entities as to what can be done to conserve our native plants and environment and manage our stormwater. So I would be an advocate for keeping what we have, at least for the time being, knowing that it is a difficult budget year coming up. I certainly think that in the future there may be other ways to address this, whether this is through internship programs with landscape architecture programs and demonstration gardens, for instance, in conjunction with the botanic garden, you know, those kinds of things. But I'd like to try to keep what we've got, but I don't know that it needs to be expanded.
So can I just clarify that we have active natural areas without stewardship contracts? So we have varying degrees of maintenance at different sites. So we have stewardship contracts at some sites and we don't have them at other sites. So, you know, do we want to talk about, you know, what sites are more important? I mean, are we okay letting natural areas not get maintained, knowing that other natural areas are getting maintained at the same park? I mean, you look at the SOSA development, and between the Park District, the Village, and the Friends, well over $100,000 has been spent, and 90 feet down the path, we have a 80 by 100 natural area that's not getting any stewardship attention at all.
Chris, I think that I actually have a very different perspective from what I think you're suggesting. Actually, the Friends of the Green Bay Trail, which I'm not on the board of, haven't been for about a year. But they just installed a new sign in SOSA. I think it was them. That talks about the importance of connectedness between natural areas. And what we have and are continuing to build as through the partnership with SOSA, through the Connect Glencoe, through the work that the Friends have done south of Harbor, is an increasingly high-quality, connected natural area. If you were to mow down the prairie that is at SOSA and say, well, we have other prairies, I think that would be really unfortunate and end up moving in the opposite direction of connectedness. I will say that the Everly Wildflower Sanctuary is stunningly beautiful and have been really impressed as I've run and walked through there recently. And the smell of the prairie in SOSA is also one of my favorite parts of Glencoe. And I think it would really be a step backwards and a loss if we were to say that's just not important to us. And while I respect Stephanie's comment about cost, I would point out that these are not facilities or assets that you can unplant and plant year by year.
Mm-hmm.
When you take it out, it is not something you can easily put back.
Agreed. I think for these areas in particular, we've made the capital investment in the past to plant them, especially the areas in Shelton Park. So the prairie pods in Shelton Park were planted out through an OSLAD grant that was done in the mid-2000s. I think from the staff perspective, at least from my perspective, I'd like to take care of what we have. And so before we continue to consider adding, you know, new plantings or new infrastructure, you know, to Josh's point, you know, once something's gone, it's gone, it's not coming back. And as these areas get farther and farther out of our control, eventually they're going to get to a point where they're just totally filled with thistle or some of the other nastier invasives. So if I was going to advocate for anything in this memo tonight, it would be to say, you know, I think we should focus on getting the natural areas we have up to, you know, a basic industry standard. Because like that area at Shelton, that's not a C-plus area. That's an area that where green is good. And that there's a lot in there that's not good.
I understand that.
I respect what you're saying, and I agree. You know, we know sustainability is a best practice in the industry. What I'm saying tonight is we're not investing enough in it to meet the goals that we've set out for ourselves.
Well, Chris, thanks for that clarification, and I will say, to Josh's point, please let's not consider removing it and replacing it with grass. I think that would not be well received. Not by me, not by people in the community. I don't think it would be. However, and I will also say when I ride past it, I'm not looking real carefully. I think, oh my goodness, this is beautiful. So I understand you know more about it and you're looking at it more closely. So I would support what you feel we need to do to at least maintain what we have as we ride this out and as things move forward a little bit more with these initiatives. And we learn more about what is the most practical thing to do. And so I would look to you to advise us on what you need to keep up these areas.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner.
And Michael?
I'm amending that on this one.
Okay. Okay, Lisa?
I think that's really good direction for this. We're going to look to maintain what we have, to allocate money in the budget to do that, but not look to add any additional areas at this time or in this budget year. Perfect.
Actually, I will say one thing that's not related to this specifically. My favorite phrase in the world. Today's CapEx is tomorrow's OpEx. And it sounds to me like this is probably a conversation that we should have had that we should have every time we look at a capital project to remind ourselves that these are the conversations that we are delaying in the future. And so personally, I like the idea of a discussion about, I'm not saying we should or should not do it, because I think Josh summed up my thoughts quite eloquently with the baseball field, but those are some of the discussions we should have. What kind of CapEx could we put in that are gonna help us not have these OpEx conversations later on? So.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we did for, and you weren't on the board, Michael, at the time. We were talking about the trail and Duke Park and plantings in that area. We had a long discussion of, like, you know, this is great to put this infrastructure in, but you know it's going to cost X, Y, and Z more to maintain it, and are you okay with doing those X, Y, and Z costs, which, Chris, will be added to the budget this year because that budget will go up to maintain that trail and Duke Park based on that. So we had that discussion. So it's just very good that we're going to make.
Rachel, we're going to put a quote on your park bench.
I'm fine with it.
Is he making a donation?
Well, you guys always get a bench when you leave the board eventually, so.
Yeah, you leave the board, you get a bench.
My donation has been in Watts passes, this year.
I love it. All right. So we're good to move on from that, I believe? Yeah. Okay, now we're going to turn it over to talk about our IT master plan update. And everything goes along with that. So I'm going to turn it over to Carol and Erin.
Erin, if you want to go through and give a brief overview of what's kind of been going on since last summer as far as the website, and then we'll evolve into discussion on the registration system and our proposed recommendation.
Absolutely. So as you might recall, last year we did a website feasibility study, and one of the things that came out of that was people don't know the difference between the registration and the website. You guys know that as well. It's hard to tell where one starts and one stops. So really from that report, it was concluded that if we're going to do one of these, we should probably do both at the same time. Our intention and what we approved as a board last year was to do a technology master plan, but then COVID hit, so we did put that on pause. In September, we started talking to a few different consultants about different opportunities. Sorry, there's a baby in the room.
I thought that was Dudley.
Honestly, Erin, I had to move up here because I don't have a baby, but I did have somebody whining and crying downstairs. So
he's only in here for a diaper change. He's about to go to bed. He's only been in here for 5 minutes. So anyway, we started talking to some consultants, and really what we wanted from a strategic IT plan, really, it didn't seem like a lot of people really offered what we wanted. And at the same time, we then learned that RecTrack,
at the same time, we learned just recently that RecTrack 10.3, which is the version of the registration system that we have, was no longer going to be supported or maintained as of the end of 2021. So at that point, we realized that really the urgency as it related to a registration system and the impact of that on the development of the website probably was our highest priority, knowing that we're kind of on the clock at this point in time to do kind of a major project with both of those. And realizing that the cost of the comprehensive strategic plan that we did get was pretty costly at $50,000, and really was a more wide-ranging look at all of our needs. And the other proposal was actually from the company that Erin used for the analysis of our websites, and it's somebody that's very familiar with park and rec agencies here in the Chicagoland area, as well as different registration systems. The cost of that proposal was much smaller, and we felt rather than bite it off in one full swoop, that it probably made more sense, especially in the pandemic, and with the way even programs are being offered these days, it probably made more sense to go with option two and to really take an analysis of what we need for a registration system. Also, in doing that, I want to be clear that there is definitely some additional operating expenditures related to the system that we pick. And purely from a cost perspective, Lisa, if you want to scroll down to this diagram. So you see in the far left column our current RecTrack system. It was purchased outright from a system. We pay a little under $7,000 a year for our annual maintenance agreement on it, and we pay a certain credit card processing fee over and above that. So you can kind of see a cost of about $105,000 a year. What they are recommending, RecTrack and several agencies, you see them listed, large agencies, Wilmette, Skokie, Waukegan, Glenview, and Gurnee, have transitioned to the 3.1 system. And they're proposing for a fee of $5,000 related to training only. They would convert us over onto our current server, which I might add was just purchased last year. Two other systems that we have taken a little bit of look at so far are the Amelia and the ActiveNet. And I just, if you drop down, you see, based on their fee structure, could potentially be $70,000 to $80,000 more per year. So these were based on actual conversations, both with Oak Park and Lindenhurst, and with Oak Brook, who currently has ActiveNet. So I totally understand that the look and the feel will also change with that. I just think there has to be an understanding of what that might result as far as the annual expenditure that we have not been paying up to this point. So I think the best thing that we can do is to start with the option two consultant to really start taking a look at our options and to really guide us as a district to determine what is most important and what these systems offer. We really, other than a verbal conversation that we've had with our customer service staff calling some of these park districts, kind of to get the pros and cons, we really need some more in-depth look at the systems and making sure that what we all need for the different departments really is what we're going to find in these systems. Some are very new. Amelia, I know, is probably the newest and probably is more like what a system that you would know as an Amazon system would look like. I also know from conversations with those districts that there are some definite downsides as far as reporting and the integration with the financial software. So I think we really need to take a real comprehensive look at what system that we go to, and then maybe as a phase two, we look to hiring a more comprehensive study of all the other technology-related systems that we have. But at this point in time, it really seems like we need to really expedite the process with our registration system and related website development.
One of the things that the company that we're, the consulting company we're proposing going with, will do is actually talk to our staff and really refine down what our priorities are, what our needs and wants are. Obviously, no software system is going to get every need and want, but she's going to really then zero in on what matches best our priorities. She's also not a salesperson for any company, so I do think she comes from more of a neutral point of view.
Carol, you also mentioned when you would go to the cloud. What would cause that?
Yeah, but there, that right-hand column of RecTrack 3.1 in the cloud really would be when we get to the point of needing to replace our current infrastructure as far as the servers. Again, as we mentioned last year, we bought new servers, and there's really no reason to do that last column. We'd be paying more money virtually just to have somebody else host that system for us. So it just doesn't really make sense at this point in time to do that. But I think what we're looking for is just some understanding and consensus that we really feel like it's okay to proceed with option two versus taking a more comprehensive look at this point in time. Does anybody have any questions or have any thoughts on that?
Look, this is Dudley. I think we've come a long way relatively fast on this, certainly since I've been on the board, being able to do credit cards, having a more extensive way to list the programs and who's teaching, you know, all the financial management. I would recommend that we go with the RecTrack as recommended.
I think just to clarify too, we don't really need to decide on a registration system at this point in time. We need to go through the full analysis, and that's why we're really recommending to go through that second option to pay the consultant $7,000 versus the the $50,000 at this point in time based on what our actual urgent needs are for the district.
So that's a bridge to the future for us.
Right.
What I understand you to be saying, Carol, is that, sorry I stepped on that, there, Dudley, is option one is an IT master plan for every piece of IT in the district, you know, including all the computers you guys type on, work on every day, and all the financial software and other software you use in your day-to-day jobs, but isn't necessarily customer-facing. And then option two is just focusing on the website and the registration software.
Yes. Yeah. The other comprehensive view kind of looks more at work order systems, facility and membership systems, IT staffing, onboarding, customer feedback and input systems, more on the systems that we feel like we could use internally here at the Park District to become more efficient. That second option, just directly related, Josh, to the website and registration, is really focusing on the external customer versus the
right.
customer.
Right.
Correct.
Right. Well, I think option two makes sense to me. Carol, let me just say one more time, you know, repeat the broken record that I would keep looking at the cloud very aggressively. I know I can see the analysis that you did and on paper, it certainly makes sense, but I at least would ask the question, like, well, how much are we paying for server maintenance, and how much are we paying for electricity, and how much are we paying for these incidentals that might make RecTrack 3.1 cloud a better deal than installing it on a server, even if we already own it?
Correct. Yes, absolutely.
I struggle a little bit with the $7,000 spent on a consultant. When I think I can see the writing on the wall that we're going to probably go down the RecTrack 3.1 cloud basis. I'm sorry?
I don't think we are, no.
Oh, you don't?
I don't think we've determined at all what we want, no.
Okay, that's good.
This is just a sampling, correct?
Correct. Right. I mean, I'll be honest, there's for park and rec agencies, as far as the system, I think we put it in our report. We went to go look at, there were six different systems, and these three are definitely the three go-to in the field. So I'm not sure what other systems really are out there that might compete with these or who uses them, but that would be part of the process of the consultant.
I mean, the way that my mind works on these things here is that, look, I think the RecTrack that we're using right now is kind of bare bones and basic, and so if we're paying $105,000 a year for that,
we're not. We're only paying really $7,000. The rest is credit card processing fees.
I read this earlier today, and I really am now struggling with what this chart says. And I think so. I would like to understand what are we paying for this? Well, I don't even understand how to read this chart then.
The chart is a cost sampling of the systems that are out there, Michael, that we have yet to look at in depth because we have not hired the consultant to help us do that.
What is the first column?
That's our current system of what we pay, RecTrack 10.3, which will be no longer maintained after next December.
Right. So we pay $105,477 for that, of which $98,000 is credit card distribution fees, right?
Correct.
Okay. So, got it. That makes a whole lot more sense to me. I did not realize the annual fee was a CCDF. We call those CCDF, credit card distribution fees. But I thought that was like just the credit card processing and other things. But I got it. Now I understand.
Yeah.
So we're talking about going from, if we were to stay with RecTrack and go to a cloud-based RecTrack, which I saw as the column all the way to the right, the incremental cost to us is 17,000, is that right?
Yeah, estimated at, it's more a little bit, 13,000. Again, it's a hosting of the system that we're going to have to pay the training fee anyways to go to.
Right.
And, you know, we're under contract 2 more years with Excalibur. We have a brand new server. I'm not sure that this is the time to do that. And that's why it's double starred. But again, that would be something for the consultant to help us evaluate.
Yeah, I struggle with this because, quite frankly, the way that I see any transition away from RecTrack, and I see this at our office quite a bit, that we want to get away from a vendor because we're not that thrilled with them, and you know, for whatever reason, the underlying the switching costs are so high to get something into your back-end system, that it often, the switching costs often outweigh the upgrade costs. And we've tried this many times at my office, as I said, tried to switch and then had to go back because the costs were high. So I personally think there's probably value if you guys, you know, you guys are gung-ho. Look, it's $7,000. This isn't the end of the world. But I think if there is a reasonable chance that you are going to go RecTrack 3.1 and upgrade and go to the cloud, like Wilmette, Skokie, Waukegan do, I don't see the need to spend $7,000 on it. But if you think there's a reasonable chance that there's something out there that's better, that does not have huge switching costs can be overwhelming, then I'm fine with it. But I guess I want to understand what the cost of switching would be. What do you guys think that is?
I think, again, Michael, that's part of the analysis, and that's why we do feel that spending $7,000 on a consultant to help us through this process is well worth it. As you know, we're a very unique agency. We've got the park side of things, the rec side, the financial side of things, the customer service to the our constituents, and then just the ease of use of the system to our constituents. All that comes into play and are all variables. And I think it's really hard for us to do that. And we did budget $45,000 in the current year for an IT consultant to come in. It's just we feel like to spend that on a comprehensive plan right now is not a good use of taxpayer money.
You know, look, as I said, it's only $7,000. I personally could see us. I think underestimating switching costs is something that occurs quite often. So I wouldn't underestimate that cost of finding a new vendor. So yeah, I mean, that's my two cents on it. Is there, and I sent this email to Lisa Shepherd earlier today, is there any way that we can work with our, like, get a consortium out there like we do with NSSRA, where we can talk to Wilmette and Skokie and Waukegan and say, hey, we're all using the system. Why don't we all renew and get a better deal?
No, we can't do that. All our systems are so different and all so specific to their agencies, there's no ability to do that.
Okay, just a thought.
This list really doesn't highlight any of the features or abilities of these different software, so it's really hard to just look at the numbers and not see, you know, pros and cons of that. That's what this consultant really will.
Sorry.
I mean, it really comes down to pros and cons and related cost. And as a board, that's where you will help us guide making the decision. Is it worth X amount of dollars to do that? We're not there by any step of the imagination right now. It's just we're trying to get the consultant to really start the process.
Yeah, and I hear you on that. When I was reading it, it made it seem like you guys. It made it seem like RecTrack 3.1 was kind of the easiest way to go. I didn't get the impression from this document. And that's why I always love, and I'm going to push Lisa Shepherd, you and I can chat about this later, like an executive summary to understand what's going on, because we get 62 pages here. It's hard to get some of the sentiment. Aaron, I would have loved to have understood that, you know, that there is more going on here that we need to understand that. And I didn't pick that up from the memo. And again, we read 62 pages of memos, so it's hard to pick all up all the nuance.
I think if you go to the last page, it kind of really it says recommendation. I think that's kind of really where
Yeah, the 62 pages, because if you want it, some people like to see all this detail in the proposals. We put all that in. The board doesn't want all this detail for the proposal. We have to take it out, but half the time I don't put it in. And then
no, I love it. That. I just want an executive summary on these big decisions, especially expenses that are over $5,000 or $10,000, to understand a little bit more, because I did not pick up on the nuances here. When I read this, I saw, we budgeted, $45,000, and we got two options of 50 and 7. But I was like, I don't understand why I don't go with RepTrack 3.1. We're already in bed with them. Maybe that, is easier.
And that's where I think, to Aaron's point, there's our pros and cons related to the customer feel, and maybe that's not what would be the best thing. So,
that's a fair point.
So I think if you read here on this page I have right here, kind of that is the summary of what we're talking about. Actually, this whole memo is just telling you what the process we're going through, and then the summary is right here with the option of what we get from that. So what we're really looking at is that we have different members of the community expect different things from our website and registration software. So they'll come in and they'll say, well, why can't it be like Amazon? I can go on Amazon, I can just click and put it in the cart. And so that's what this helps us do, is evaluate those different softwares to see if they provide those opportunities. A million may not. And if that amenity is worth a lot more money. And we won't figure that out until we go through this whole process with the consultant that will interview our staff. They'll have focus groups with the board. They'll have focus groups with residents and user groups. That all comes together to get the best plan for the district.
To go to 3.1 RepTrack, it is like a big amount of work. So either way, we're going to be doing.
I did not pick that up here. What I even in the recommendation where I see that, look, attempting to make registration software changes and changes the website seems like an overwhelming undertaking. Quite frankly, I think either one independently is an overwhelming undertaking. That's why I thought that sticking with that RepTrack software was less of a quote-unquote overwhelming undertaking.
So just to tie it up, Stephanie, are you in agreement with option two?
Yeah, and it really helps what you just said about the focus groups, because that's where my head was going, like how are you testing it? Yeah. So I think that's great, because then you'll know from people that it's useful or easier to use. I have only one question. Is it cheaper user fees to migrate to that RepTrack 3.1 because we already spent that $51,000 in 2012? Or you might not know that answer, but I was just curious.
Yeah, that $5,000 is basically a training fee to train our staff on all the new features of how it's different from 3.1 is different than 10.3.
Because you're already training from that initial.
Correct.
Is that forever?
Until they have a new upgrade, I would assume.
Okay. Well, I would just add that this staff does not have anyone on staff that can take on this role, an expert, an IT expert, that could take on the role that this consultant is being asked to do, and I think its expert advice is well worth it, especially at this level, and I would absolutely agree that it makes sense to use them. So you have your answer, Lisa. What's next?
Okay, so now we're done with that. So we're going to give ad staff to go and pass back with recreation results to start that process to go. We're going. Okay, so now I'm going to go through all the contracts, which you can read or not. And now we're going to, hold on, we're almost there. We're going to turn over to, let's catch up now. Proposed Capital Fund 65 item for consideration. So last year you requested to see these items a little bit sooner in the, it's not catching up here.
Can I go to PowerPoint, Lisa?
Yep, I'm gonna stop sharing. You can go, you pull it up, okay?
Sure.
Okay. So we're bringing earlier for consideration and discussion proposed Capital Fund 65 items for next budget year. And at the end, we're also going to be talking just a little bit about some of the Fund 65 that we delayed this year. Maybe talk about bringing one of those back to do based on need. So, throwing it over to Chris.
Thank you, Lisa.
Okay. Carol, do you just want to break down the projected balances and our kind of our situation with Fund 65 right now?
Yeah, right now, because we did delay a majority of the projects, we're expecting, and also with the close to 99% collection of taxes, just to remind everybody that we do transfer from corporate funds via the corporate tax levy to the Capital Fund Project 65 fund to do these types of projects. And because we did delay quite a few projects and only did what was deemed essential by the board earlier this year, we are looking to have about a $370,000 carryover into the new year, and then that matched with the $500,000 that we transfer annually from the corporate fund will be about $870,000 available to do these types of projects.
So in this presentation, you will see a few items that are highlighted as rolled over. So those were particular amenities or pieces of equipment that we still felt were valuable in replacing, but that we had chose not to purchase this year. So that's some of that funding that Carol indicated. If there's any questions during, there's a number of slides. I'm sure everybody's already tired at 8:30. Please, you know, feel free to jump in and ask questions. And if I have the information tonight, I will give it to you. And if not, I can get back to you with it. So first and foremost, the easy slide. Bobby.
The recreation slide. So as you all know, we have a very successful sailing and aquatics camp. This is a rollover item for last year. It's not a keeping the lights on item by any means, but this program has been very successful and we want to keep it that way. We feel that it is necessary to keep investing in it. This will allow us to offer sailors and campers the ability to sail in boats by themselves. We'll also be able to add additional type of programming at the beach, allow for better skill development. As I said last year when we were going through this, really we're doing more of the fun rides right now in those camps. And we really want to make sure we develop the program into more skill-based and keep the kids in the sports and the activities longer. So staff recommends that we roll it over to next fiscal year.
I have one thing to say on this, is that this sounds like the most efficient use of, if 2021 is like 2020, this camp is like the best camp for socially distant that...
Yep.
I could not think of a better way. I would actually personally want to increase this budget so we can have more kids at this socially distant camp.
Yeah, we're going to try and maximize as much as we can, obviously. But whether we have COVID or not, we will make a lot of use out of these boats.
Yeah.
Nobody ever says that about HVAC units, Michael.
I have a couple questions that I already sent to Lisa Shepherd on some of your stuff later, so we'll get there.
We'll get there.
Question about the boats.
Okay.
Are these additional or are they replacing existing?
They're additional. Right now what we're doing is putting groups of 6 to 10 kids on a catamaran together. This would give the ability to put them in more more boats, and they have the ability for kids to be able to steer the boats. They're made from a high-density rotomold, so they're very durable with at least 10 to 15 years of life expectancy.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Okay, next.
All right, so next up we have the ELC condenser and air handler rebuild. So exciting, right? This piece of equipment was installed in the 2008 renovation. We have three of these units. They have a projected service life of 15 years before they require a rebuild. So we're conservatively recommending a phased replacement cycle of the three units so we don't have to spend $400,000 to $500,000 in 1 year on replacing these units and have them all reach the end of life simultaneously. So you'll see the top picture is the what we call the penthouse above Children's Circle. So this unit provides heating, cooling, and air filtration for Children's Circle, GJK, and ELC classrooms as well in that area. So our goal is to replace this before it fails. We have had significant reliability issues with this unit already 2 times. So the below picture, you'll see that unit out on the roof will get replaced, and the above picture will be rebuilt with new components. I'm sure there's questions on this one, right?
I have a question on this one. With COVID and the general concern about indoor air quality, will this improve the air quality inside the backup center?
I will say, I would say it will improve the air quality because I won't be concerned that the unit's going to break down. So we did have two major breakdowns in this unit last fiscal year. One of them we were very lucky in having some spare parts on hand, and the other one was the emergency repair that the board authorized in August. So I think that these units, it's really important to maintain the continuity of operation with them.
Yeah, that doesn't exactly get at my question. The question is, does this improvement or rework of what we have now, can that be structured such that it improves the well-being and the quality of the interior air in tech?
Asking about like one of those UV things that...
Yeah, so this unit does have a special air filter that was outfitted to it this year, which is a needlepoint bipolar ionization unit, which... is way above and beyond what you typically find in this application. I will say that the price that you see here is a budget estimate to replace the unit in kind. I'm certain that we can add additional filtration or something of that nature to the unit, but there would be additional costs that would go along with that.
Could we get that as an option on the bidding?
Well, this we're likely going to go through a co-op to replace this. So that fee will include, it's an all-in fee for engineering, so it's definitely something that we could explore and further assign some cost to and come back to the board with before we are asking the board to pull the trigger on this.
Well, I'm just saying this as an opportunity to improve the air quality in tech.
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
So is the plan here to replace just one unit now and then one unit later? Is that the deal?
So my thought process, Michael, is to do one unit in each of the next three fiscal years. So basically the first unit will be replaced at 13.5 years old,
yep.
The second at 14.5, and the third at 15.5.
This seems like a sound plan to me.
Yeah, thank you.
Agreed. Stephanie?
Agreed. Sorry, it took me a while to catch my mute.
Okay, next. And Josh?
Sorry, I had to step away for a minute to take care of something.
What's okay. Are you in agreement? Did you catch this whole condenser situation?
No. Sorry, but you don't need to rewind for me. Just I trust you guys to make the right decision.
Sounds good. What's up next?
Okay, so... the early childhood parking lot, again, it was installed in the 2008 facility renovation. We have already milled and overlaid all the other parking lots at Takeoff that were done at the same time as this, which included the lot behind the gym and the lot at the community center entrance. The east end is in very poor condition with significant cracking and drainage issues. We did look at doing some patches 2 years ago. We did some patches around the structures and in a few other areas, but I think we've probably come past the point. Any patch that we would do now would probably be 60 or 70% of the entire lot at this point. So I think that we probably want to put a earmark in this to do the whole lot. This is a big one, I know.
Thank you.
Guys, and I doubt they do, but... when we take fees from, my God, I'm tired, so I'm forgetting. GJK, where my kids went for 3 years. Do we take any money from that and set it aside for these kind of repairs and those outside of the building? Like, where does this money come from? Is this Fund 65? Is this Fund 69?
So this money would be at corporate out of Fund 65, which is tax money.
Okay, just curious.
So, Carol, could you comment on where the GJK money goes, the surplus from them?
Carol?
Did I lose her?
I was on mute, sorry. It goes into the general surplus for the recreation fund.
So that money ends up in Fund 69?
Yes. Ultimately, with the exclusion of this year. And likely not next year.
Right.
the other parking lots. I never understand how they're so expensive, and I always hate to see the numbers, but it is what it is.
I would say it's not a sexy project. So some of these
need it, you know, just yes or no.
Another question. Can you replace this with a metal roof?
Yes.
Would it make economic sense?
I'm sorry?
Would it make economic sense to replace it with a metal seam roof?
I think there's an economic indicator there, but there's also an aesthetic. It would definitely change the look of the facility, so I think that that's certainly something that we could explore. I would imagine that we probably have the flexibility for that in this price. So, if that's something the board feels strongly on, we can look for more additional feedback on that.
This makes me laugh because you know Dudley and I like the metal roof. I think we've been at this dance before.
Well, I like the metal roof too. I just know that it's going to be different, and anytime anything's different, there has to, you know, be a little dialogue on that.
Sure. Yes, yes.
Well, it's a pretty simple roof, so it should be helpful that it's not very complex.
Yeah. Correct. Yep. Correct.
I actually think putting a metal roof on there, and I love the idea, Dudley. I personally don't look at the aesthetic of a roof and think, oh my gosh, this is great or terrible. But I like the idea of if it's the same price range and it's something that's sustainable, you know, I think that that's something we could certainly market.
Great. Well, what I'll do is I'll do a little due diligence on a metal roof, and if it's a significant increase, I'll come back to the board and we can have that discussion. Does that sound good, Lisa?
That sounds great. Great. Thank you, Chris. Any other comments on the roof? Okay. What's up next?
I fully support roofs.
Excellent. Thank you. So this is a rollover item from this year's fiscal budget. This is a 21-year-old pickup truck. This is one of our plow trucks. We are recommending replacing this vehicle based on the fact that it is at the end of its useful life.
I think opening the door up and taking a picture was a very wise idea.
Well, this is one of those things that has a stop sign as a floorboard.
Listen, I'm surprised there's not duct tape on one of the chairs. So this is the item that we deferred right at when COVID started, right? Right when we were
That's correct.
Yeah, I remember.
That's correct.
Let's do it.
Okay. Any objections to this?
I'm gonna put my inner Dudley on. Can we get an electric vehicle?
Not one that can push snow.
That'd be tough.
We could get diesel, but it'll be about 15% more in cost. So, no takers on that one, I think, yeah.
I mean, diesel gets better gas miles, but I'm okay. No, I'm fine with it. This one's my favorite one. The next one's my favorite because I had to ask Lisa Shepherd what a skid steer is.
So it's also known as a Bobcat. Track loader, wheeled loader. There's lots of nasty nicknames for these pieces of equipment. My staff call it Wally, like from the Disney movie. But so what we're doing is, this is another one of the items that came off the Keeping the Lights On list that we gave the board earlier this year. The unit is 17 years old. It's had a number of breakdowns. We use it for unloading construction materials and clearing snow, which gets a lot of use at the ice rink in particular. In addition, in the last three fiscal years, we've spent nearly $16,000 renting a track unit because of the lack of function of this unit to be used at the beach. So our thought process is, while this is due for regular replacement, we should replace it with a track unit and have that savings in the operating budget as well, and it will save us some additional time down at the beach. But I expect it to get a lot of use in the park system, clearing snow, making it, doing projects, being used at the beach, all types of things like that.
Any questions or objections to this expense?
No.
I have just one question.
Go ahead, Michael.
I'm sure it's not going to be one you're going to love. Can we rent these things?
Absolutely.
And is there a benefit to leasing it from any financial perspective at all, or from a maintenance perspective at all?
There is. It is something we've looked at. I mean, they can go from between about $1,800 to $2,500 a week. So the issue with, them doing long-term rentals is obviously the availability of the unit. Also, when companies rent you units, they don't typically love for you to move them around between job sites. They like them to be in one place. They can get a little sensitive about renting you a unit with a trailer. Yeah. Because there's additional liabilities that go along with that.
I will tell you, 2 years ago, we had a loader go down and we rented a unit for the season. It was like $7,000. I think we're going to get a lot of flexibility out of owning it that we wouldn't necessarily get out of renting it.
Okay. I'm fine with it. One more question. I'm sorry, Chris.
No. These are great questions, Michael.
Who maintains this? Do you guys have mechanics on staff?
That's a great question. So as part of the village's shared service agreement, we manage and pay for the cutting of 9.5 acres of village property. So it's like 27 unique sites that we manage and we pay for. And in that, they trade us the use of their 2, now 3, full-time mechanics.
Okay.
So all of our fleet vehicles and equipment are maintained by the village. All we pay for is parts. In addition, that's also where we get our gasoline. There are some dealer-specific repairs that we do farm out, but 90% of our maintenance is performed by Village of Glencoe staff.
Smart. Thank you. Am I the only commissioner that didn't know that? You guys all know that.
You're the only one.
You're the only one.
They actually are awesome. We also share a lot of equipment. So we use their equipment, they use our equipment. It saves us a lot on rental fees.
Great.
Okay.
Okay. So the equipment material trailer. So we are recommending, this is another fun item, right? Recommending the replacement of the equipment material trailer. It's 22 years old. The trailer is not rated for the current weights of our equipment, like our new skid steer that we would be purchasing. In addition, the loading ramps are cumbersome and not ideal. This is one of those pieces of equipment that is at the end of its useful life and does a lot of trailering for us when we move mowers around and other pieces of equipment and construction materials.
Okay. So amortized over, if this lasts 22 years, is a pretty good deal.
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah.
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 Okay. Any thoughts, any questions for Chris? Okay, so I will assume this is approval.
Okay.
All right.
So, like our same favorite topic from earlier, baseball infield, outfield maintenance. So, what we talked about obviously was, you know, some type of a capital outlay, whether it's on a regular or non-routine, semi-regular basis. If we have 4 baseball fields, we can, you know, assume that this is about 1.5 to 2% of the replacement value of those fields that we would be investing. I see this paying for infield maintenance, some resodding, clay being added to all 4 of our fields, potentially a foul ball net on top of the Berlin dugouts. That's one bit of feedback that we got from the users this year, is that we're knocking a lot of balls out on the greenwood there. So. Any particular questions about this?
Nope, go ahead.
Okay. It's a great photo, isn't it? The Watts Basement HVAC unit. So this unit was originally installed in 2002, making it 19 years old. This was one of the items identified in the ACG facility report and the white design replacement report. This has been included in the park grant. So if for some reason we do end up receiving the park grant, fingers crossed, this is an item that we would not use. Okay.
And that goes with the next unit, also with the fire suppression, right, Chris?
Yes, it does. So at the Watts Ice Rink, we currently do not have a fire suppression system. And our fire alarm is a mix of components from the 1980s and 2002. Which causes us routine problems when it rains. So what this is a placeholder for professional services to design a new system. That system would then be designed in this fiscal year and installed in the following year. I do expect this number to come down a little bit in the final draft, but basically it's a placeholder, and if we do get the park grant, this is money that we would not spend.
Any questions? No? Okay, moving on. Any objections? No?
I'll go back.
Just
okay.
One question. Ross, didn't we replace the HVAC units last year?
That's a good question, Stephanie. We replaced the 4 large HVAC units that do the first floor. The basement HVAC unit provides heating and cooling to the basement and the front bathrooms in the building. It's a very small unit.
Okay.
It's the last heater slash air conditioner at that facility to be replaced.
Good question, sir.
Yep. Okay. So, tuck point and gutter this in the 20 kind of a phase B as an alt.
So what?
Chris, you're breaking up.
Okay. Can you guys hear me now?
Yes.
So this scope of work was identified in the BLS report that was done with the Baird survey as needing to be on our front burner. We had originally included it in the 2019 halfway house restoration project, but the funding wasn't as such that we could do the halfway house and the beach house, so we chose to do the halfway house first. This was last, work on the exterior was last done in the 1990s. So is there any specific questions, concerns? Go ahead, sorry.
Wasn't this in the sort of intermediate attention list in that report?
It was. It was in the 3 to 5 year plan, I believe, yeah. And that with that report, I believe we received 4 years ago. Or Teresa Shepherd, is that 4 years ago?
4 years ago, yeah.
Yeah. Right. So we prioritized it just based on the degrading condition of the outside of the beach house. I will say that there is an 18% contingency in this number based on our previous bids. I felt that that was prudent based on the age of the beach house, and you know, sometimes you start getting into these things and you find something that can be pretty gnarly, so there is a little bit of wiggle room there. I hope we don't need that full amount, but I think we need to protect ourselves based on the age of the structure.
And if you go down there and look at that, you would, in person, pictures really doesn't do it justice. It really does need to be done before the grades even more. So.
Yeah. And so and this also includes contract fees for BLS, because this is obviously a historic renovation, so we want to make sure that it's period accurate and, you know, appropriate for our application.
Okay, no, any questions for Chris? Any objections to this? Okay, so moving on.
Okay, so we're at a point where the roof is bad on the GYS building. So what we're proposing is in the next fiscal year that we do not give GYS their stipend, and we apply that money towards the capital work that needs to be done at that facility. Based on the small size and the, it's not a very tall building, we anticipate being able to do the roof in-house with our own in-house staff. The $22,000 is a placeholder based on the fact that the chimney's in pretty poor condition and it needs to be tuck pointed, so there'll be some by staff work and some by contractor work. We also have to determine if we do proceed with it, if we want to have a shake roof on the building to match the existing Berlin structures, or if we just want to return to asphalt. If we do that, I believe we'll also see the price come down.
Or maybe even metal.
Yes. You can even explore that if the board wanted to.
Can I ask
you? Talk about this with Glencoe U Services at all, or no?
Not yet.
And we have to do, I mean, this is something we have to do?
Yeah. I would say there's a lot back to the building.
You know, my question is about whether we have to do this, because I know discussions in the past have really centered around the fact that we're giving GYS a budget of $2,000 for repairs every year for this building, because it is in not very good shape. Besides what we're suggesting here, the inside is not good shape. And we've always had discussions around the idea that when this building fails, we're not going to be using it anymore, we're going to get rid of it. So if we start investing money in something like this, we're making a decision to continue to upgrade and keep this building that, it's my understanding, we do not use that much and has lots of other problems. So
We were thinking, well, you're right, that's why we're recommending not giving GYS their stipend in place of doing this for this year, definitely. But the more staff talked about it, the more we see a use for this building if GYS would go away. Maybe not for, maybe for programming, may not, maybe for maintenance. Okay. Storage of things, since we lost the Linden House garage. We used to store a lot of stuff in there. So we are looking at being able to use this in the future.
Good. Okay, that justifies it to me. Thank
so
you.
I will say, you know, I think Lisa Brooks, you hit the nail on the head with, like, hey, if we're investing in this building, we need to use it. Chris Lanier, are you aware of how frequently the police are called to get kids off of the roof of that building?
There's an issue with a lot of vandalism at that site in the past. Again, that's a fairly common occurrence in the park district world for kids to get on the building roof. It happens to take it more regularly than we'd like to, you know, discuss, but...
It happens a lot, too.
Yeah. Other than cutting down the trees or the privacy fence, I think it'd be a tough nut to crack to prevent that.
Well, that's what's going to happen.
Get a metal roof. Get a metal roof and put trees on it.
I like the way you think.
We need to put spikes on the roof.
I feel like we're watching National Lampoon's Vacation where they put the grease on the sled. But you know, could you put spikes on there or something to kind of, like? Is there something we can do to prevent that? Because I know, quite frankly, I'm not going to mention any personal relative of mine that has contemplated climbing up on there before I threatened to disown them, but it's fairly common. Like, and I walk by there at night, and you see the police there ripping kids off of that thing. I think if we're going to drop $22,000 in it, it would be nice if we could do something. I just don't want a kid falling off of there getting hurt.
That Irma's going to probably tell you that a participant getting stabbed is a much bigger risk to you than a participant climbing on the roof and falling off. I mean, they're not typically a fan from a liability standpoint of, like, spiked security fences or, those kinds of things. They usually will tell you that you're covered if somebody shimmies up a light pole and gets onto your roof versus putting barbed wire around the outside of the building.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yep. No, it doesn't make sense, but I believe you. I'll say that.
It's true, though.
Zero sense to me.
Yeah.
I believe you.
I mean, you can be liable for security, but you can't be. It's harder to be liable for stupid.
Any other thoughts on this or questions for Chris?
No, I'm fine with it. I was just wondering if there's a way that we could do something to prevent it. But if you can't prevent it, you can't prevent it.
Well, look, we'll contact Paderma to see what we are able to do. But in the meantime, we'll also ask when public safety does patrols do. Remind them to look on our roofs, but keep in mind that does happen to a lot of our buildings, and hopefully we catch them and then the parents do this.
I mean, we could put a security light on the chimney or something like that, a motion sensor light to light the whole top of the thing up. I mean, because it happens all the time at the beach house. That's how the tiles all have been broken on the beach house roof as well. So it's a pretty fairly common occurrence, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think you're hearing, the reason you're hearing me talk about this one is this happens to be my dog walking past, and I walk her at night, and I see kids up there. So I'm sure, I didn't even think that happened at the places. I thought this was the easiest one to access.
Well, it's definitely something we can look into, Commissioner, and get back to you guys with some ideas, so.
I've seen kids on walks, too, so.
Yeah, they broke one of the this year, yeah.
I think it's a thing.
Yep, it is.
How will this be used, the continued use of the building? I thought Lisa was going to suggest that we knock the whole building down for $22,000.
No, GYS is still using it. They're still using it. Yeah, they're still a viable organization. They provide service to the community. I don't think anybody's ever suggested we not continue to write with them. So Lisa's point was, if why invest money if we don't think we're going to use the building in the future? And I think we kind of
change our point of view on this building after selling Lindenhouse, Woosnack Garage, and, you know, this might be a...
So we would have a secondary use for storage, something like that?
Should the TYS ever not use it?
Oh, okay.
You would guess that I could probably fit a lawnmower through those two double doors there, Gunther.
Not saying that we go in and do cosmetic things to the inside the building for GYS, but this is a structural necessity for this building.
Okay. Yeah.
Very good.
Okay.
Good question, though, Lisa. Anything else on the GYS?
Nope. Yeah, I have two comments.
Okay, go ahead, Josh.
They're totally contradictory, and so I'll staff. Figure out how to deal with these two contradictory ideas. One is that, just as a matter of courtesy, if we're contemplating not giving them their stipend this year, let's broach that subject with them sooner rather than, you know, kind of when they're expecting to receive it.
Oh, no, it's already on my list once you approve this, so, yep.
Second is, I may be misremembering, but I thought at one point one of my fellow commissioners pointed out that GYS has like $100,000 in the bank or something.
No, it's the GJHP that does. Yeah, GJHP has more money than GYS.
That was me misremembering that. Okay.
Yeah.
And also, so you're talking about the $2,000 stipend for the building, but don't we also give them like $10,000 a year?
Right, so we would not give them that money. So they would lose any financial support next year.
Okay.
I don't think that's a good idea. I just wonder how they're going to survive without that $10,000. I'm a little concerned. Well, it's up to you. If you guys want to tell us, no, we want to fix the roof and give them a stipend, that's well within your right to do. That's just that was our recommendation.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think if we're going to use the, if we want to, I think they're two independent discussions here. If Chris sees this as being his future tool shed, lawnmower shed, we're going to have to fix the roof anyway. So I consider them independent. I agree with Josh. That's why I asked before. You got to give GYS the heads up. If they vacate, then the building is ours. If they vacate and they can't use it because of $10,000 that they're expected to receive, I don't think that's the park district's challenge. I think it's their challenge, right?
We don't have to have that discussion tonight. We can bring that back next month to talk about what you want to do with this, a stipend or not. Okay.
I have to fix the roof. Okay.
We're going to fix the roof, though. Okay. I believe that ends our slides, right, Chris?
For me, there's some IT slide, but I think we've already settled that.
We've already settled that, so we are good.
Hey, we were going to mention...
The one thing I want to mention is that last year, in March, we tabled replacing the top gym floor.
Yeah.
Staff is recommending that we replace that this year. Just the wear and tear, we're running full blast with our Children's Circle and ELC and DJK, and we really feel we need to replace that floor. It's really showing a lot of wear and tear. So, with your approval, we would like to go ahead with that and probably it would take place in January or probably January.
The lowest qualified bidder has indicated that they're willing to stand by their pre-pandemic price. So we would have to, you know, seek board consensus tonight and then bring it back to the board for formal approval in a later meeting because it's over $25,000.
Okay, so quick roll call. I'm fine with you moving forward.
Can you give us how much?
Can't hear you.
Do you remember how much it was, Chris, off the top of your head?
Yeah, I can tell you. One second.
It was like 35.5
or something like that, but yeah. We also had to replace some of the program equipment in there at the same time because it was getting torn out for the floor. So, Bobby, I think it's 42 or 43 altogether.
I think it was 14,000 additional climber equipment, the coat racks that were attached to the wall, and other pieces that are attached to the floor.
the I'll tell you exactly how much the floor was. The floor was $35,000 plus the $14,000 for the program equipment.
Just want to bring up my idea of, I know it's not going to be appropriate now, but after COVID, of, you know, revisiting renting out that room for birthday parties and marketing that a little bit more.
Hey, where would the funding come from this? For this?
Fund 65.
And we have sufficient funds available for this?
We do.
Right now, we do. Yeah.
We do, yes. Correct. Yes.
Sounds like a must do, so
everybody agree? Yeah?
Okay.
All right.
I think we should replace it with a metal roof.
That little playhouse is going to have a metal roof. All right.
We'll put that on the November or the December board agenda then?
Yes, so, correct.
No barbed wire and no spikes, though, please.
Correct.
Okay. You're no fun. Yeah, he will bring that. Well, he'll get the quotes and everything. We'll bring that forward in the cyber boarding.
Sounds good.
All right.
On to the discussion on watch season passes.
Okay, we know this is getting late, so we'll try to keep this as brief as possible. Yeah. Bobby, where's Bobby? We want to bring you up to date on status. I know I emailed you a lot during this whole process. Who would think we would sell that many passes in such a short time? So. To throw it over to Bobby to give updates.
Absolutely. So, yes, lots has been a busy couple of weeks. So, just going back to how we decided how many passes we could sell. When we started out, we looked at the traditional schedule and we added in some additional open skating times. And the goal was to get pass holders at least twice a week, if not three times a week, to be able to skate at the rink, with one of those days being Friday night, Saturday, or Sunday. We passes on a sale at 9 a.m. on the 23rd, and they sold out in 45 minutes, and we sold 600, which was with the ability to offer 1,200 people skating a week, twice a week for people. We opened a wait list once the passes sold out, and we put 200 people on the wait list very fast. So we took a breath. We knew we obviously had to relook at the schedule and rework everything. And as a team, we decided that it was more beneficial, obviously, for the community to skate as much as possible, to get as many people skating. So we removed any opportunity to do any private rentals for one-off groups while not touching the existing permanent renters who've been with us a significant amount of time. So Adam and our team worked really hard. We effectively doubled the amount of public skate available, obviously at the cost of not doing private rentals, and we were able to take 200 people off the wait list that Tuesday after Friday. We then reopened up the wait list on the Thursday in the evening, and then it was opened up to non-residents on the Friday morning. At this current point, we have removed all residents from the wait list as of today. So we have 1,072 passes sold. We have the ability to have just under 1,100 people at the rink between Friday afternoon and Sunday night for public skate. So there will be at least one available spot during that time for pass holders, and then a spot during the week too. So the goal would be if pass holders wanted to, they could at minimum skate twice a week, which we thought was a very reasonable amount of skating based on the number of times people skate. We do fully appreciate that there's going to be people who use it once. There's going to be people who use it as many times as they can. We thought this was a good way to get as many people skating as possible. Hockey passes, it's a little different skating as it's non-traditional time, so they might skate earlier in the morning or they skate late at night. 2 o'clock on a Sunday is traditionally not the busiest time for open hockey. So we have a little bit more flexibility there. So this is just a breakdown of the passes we have sold. You will notice that there is 29 people on the wait list right now. There is also 45 people on the skating wait list that have not come off yet, which are all non-members that got on that right. So since we last talked in October, the state have multiple groups of 25. So currently, we could have two groups on the main rink, and we could have one group on the studio. So we can take 75 people on the rink for public skate at once, and part of our restructuring was to have open skate at the same time on the studio and main rink and give priority to people who register ahead of time on the main rink and then people who register later for their spot on the studio. The BCEO, we did... Does somebody have a question?
Yeah, sorry, quick question. Are we... So now that we've gone from 50 to 25, are we thinking about extending the hours to be like 10, 11 o'clock at night on Saturdays to kind of meet the demand at all?
So actually, the way we redid the schedule, this doesn't impact us that much with the 25, because before what we were going to do was groups of 50 on the main rink and 25 in the studio. Now what we're going to do is 25 in the studio and two groups of 25 split in the middle on the main rink. So if we are on really busy days where we're maxed out, we'll have to split the main rink in half.
Oh, you're going to cut the main rink in half?
Yeah.
Put a temporary... You guys are so smart. I would never have thought of that.
So we've thought through a lot of it. We've gone through a significant amount of options. And so if we only had, say, 10 people turn up on a day, we're not going to split the main rink. We'll let them use the main rink. So staff will monitor and adjust. We also had the discussion at the last meeting. There was some concern about mask wearing. Clearly, things have not got better in the state of Illinois, and there was a lot of loopholes and discussions. The state has reaffirmed that hockey is a high-risk sport, and they're saying that it is only allowed non-contact practices and training only, which means that there's no scrimmaging. So that hasn't changed. We did talk to Poderma, talked to the local health department, and each of them basically didn't give us an answer on whether face masks were required. Poderma said to talk to the health department. The health department couldn't really give us an answer on it. But staff talking to other people in the industry, discussing it a lot, are making the recommendation that hockey players should be required to wear masks when they're at our facilities, even during their practice.
A
bubble mask is included that, so they can wear a regular mask or a bubble mask, and that is pretty much industry standard with Park District.
Sorry, it's not a bubble mask. It's a bubble shield over their hockey helmet or a mask.
Correct.
Got it.
So that's what Park District rinks are going with that guy. Practices are allowed under the guidance, as we already talked about. Here's where we need a little bit more guidance from the board. Most of the teams are doing what's called a 5-on-5 flow drill, which is a drill that can be perceived as a scrimmage. And as you know, scrimmages are not allowed. We are hearing from all the other rinks that a lot of the teams, this is the only drill that they can do where they're really not, the kids aren't getting bored or they're getting some value out of their practice. A part of this is what the public will see and what the public will think. They may think that this is a scrimmage, even though it's technically a drill. So there is a public perception issue there. There's also, just to let you know, about $61,000 worth of permanent renter ice that we have to confirm with the renters in the next couple of days/weeks to confirm that we can continue to do practices for hockey players. About $8,000 of ice is for miscellaneous hockey rentals, which we are not able to do because we added those additional public skate time. So I guess our question for the board, is the board okay with hockey rentals that may look like a scrimmage?
I'll go first on this one because, again, I'm probably the only person that has a kid that's on a hockey team sponsored by one of our lovely... competitor park districts. I think the consideration here has to be the fact that we are a little bit more public facing than others. We're outside. North Shore Ice Arena does not let any visitors in. Winnetka only lets one parent or one person per player in, although it's not really enforced. To me, I could go go either way. I'd actually like to hear what the other commissioners think. But I don't necessarily think it is up to us to overrule what the state's guidance is. If the hockey team calls it a 5-on-5 flow, so be it. But I can understand sensitivity to it because we're outside and we are public facing. But I think we could also, yeah, I understand why you're asking the question, Bobby, but my ultimate, I think letting the state guidelines be our guidelines, and that's probably why I didn't get a good answer from Federma on even the mask, because the state guidelines are pretty clear whether we agree with them or not. I think that's probably why you're not getting a straight answer. So my vote would be, I think you have to let the hockey, not you have to, my suggestion would be to let the hockey teams do what they are doing, so long as it is not a scrimmage. If there's a 5-on-5 drill that may look like a scrimmage, they should just explain it's a 5-on-5 drill and not a scrimmage. And I'm okay with that.
Anyone else?
There's a lot of hockey drama with, you know, just people know that they're going to tournaments. There's a lot of talk of it with the school. The school issued something about travel. So in terms of, I don't know, I feel like there's much worse going on. I don't know how to say this. I'm trying to say it and, you know, not anything incriminating, but we're outside, which makes it 90% better than the other rinks right away, I feel. But there's just a lot going on with hockey, so I do think there's a sensitivity because you don't know who's going to say something. A lot of people definitely are talking about the hockey community right now. There's a lot of spread in Northbrook. There's three hockey teams that are in quarantine right now. So, you know, it's going to be an issue. You know, hopefully we don't have that issue. I do think that we're outside is a little bit better. If we could say the same thing about soccer. You know, soccer's been the same way in the summer, too. They said that they weren't playing games, but, you know, they were playing games. It looks like a game when you're doing a scrimmage. So I would say we see how it goes. If we're having an issue or we're hearing bad feedback, can't we readjust it at that point?
Yeah, Stephanie, I could not agree more with what you're saying. I think there are certain, like, I know Tessa's on the U12. The U14 girls team is on quarantine right now. I appreciate that we're outside. I think, Bobby, are you, I would presume that you are going to require it, everyone's on the same team for these 5-on-5 drills. Like, we're not allowing two separate teams to come on and 5-on-5 drill each other, are we?
The challenge is, when we do private rentals, and after talking to Federma, it's very hard for us to enforce this, unless we have FI watching the whole time. For example, one of the teams, they may have it, we won't know that at the time.
Right. But we could put in our rental agreement that you agree that everybody is on a roster on your team, and that if people who are not rostered on your team, because you have to roster, that's the way that AHI works, if people are rostered, are not rostered on your team, and they come, you are forfeiting your right to play here again and your rental fee. I mean, you could write it down. I'm not saying we have to enforce it, but we could put it in writing to kind of at least cover ourselves, saying that we're doing what we can as a park district to prevent this.
I mean, that's really what it comes down to. We can put it in writing to all the teams, and we're not just talking youth, we're also talking adults. We have a lot of adult rental groups. So Federma allows us to say, if you rent and you tell them, here are you have to follow the guidelines set by the state, and they don't do it, that's on them, that's not on us.
Right.
So that's the legal part of it, right? We wouldn't be legally in trouble for that because we inform the renters. What we're talking about is optics. And are you okay if someone goes walking by with their dog or playing in the field next door or whatever, and they see this happening, a game, and then they call and yell, how dare you let them play hockey?
Right, and that's where I think we fall back on. But Lisa, that's where I think we fall back on, you know, tell people it has to be one team, it has to be the same people, you can't have games. And look, if we hear about it once, we say we fall back. If we hear about it twice, you know, that's where I think Stephanie's recommendation is, look, we keep a vigilant ear on this, and we kind of go as is. I think...
We have to be prepared that we're going to hear about it immediately.
We're going to hear about it immediately, so you have to be...
We're going to hear about it within the first year,
too.
Yeah. Let me add my two cents here. In one of my previous jobs, I dealt a lot with the IRS and tax structures to make maximum benefit of the tax code. And the phrase that our lawyers brought up time and time again was form over substance. And if no matter what you call it, it is what it is. And so, like, if it looks like a scrimmage, I would say it is a scrimmage, no matter what you call it. And the rules are in place to keep us safe, and I think, you know, we ought to abide by those rules. And there, I mean, evidence has shown over the past couple of months that people will push boundaries, and they'll see what they can get away with. And I don't think we ought to put our staff in a position of trying to tell somebody that's in the middle of practice, no, you can't do that. Nor do I want to be responsible for the spread of COVID in what is, according to the state, a high-risk sport. So I guess my two cents is, if it looks like a scrimmage, it is a scrimmage, no matter what you call it, and we don't allow scrimmages because the state doesn't allow them.
I know health is more important than money, but I just want to ask, if we tell them they can't do this and they don't rent from us, how much money are we losing? Because, I mean, WAPS is expensive. So I just wanted to know. And not that I'm saying health isn't, you know, that's not more important, but what are we talking about if we lose these hockey teams?
$61,000. We are working on contingency plans. You know, the ice could be used for more public skating, and in theory we could sell a couple more passes. Not going to make up $61,000, though.
I agree with you that it is what it is, but you know, and sometimes form over substance matters. I don't want to presuppose, A, that we're going to get phone calls. We may, and I think, Bobby, you're right, we likely will, but I don't know for certain. And B, I think we have a pretty good answer for these people, saying that, look, we have some scrimmages, some drills look like scrimmages. We have informed every single renter as part of the rental agreement that they are not to do scrimmages, that they have to maintain, you know, the same people, and that they risk losing their ability to skate at our facility, which is one of the only outdoor and safe facilities, if they break the rules. And I think that that's enough of a mitigation plan that makes me feel comfortable with renting it out to these hockey clubs, because we have at least done what we can to prevent it. And if we see something, it's a little bit like Anthony Scalia in the Supreme Court. If you see something that's blatantly out there, I think we'll be able to handle that. If we get enough calls about one or, you know, one team or one event, we should be able to handle that.
Yes, Michael. First of all, let me apologize because I said my little clever thing backwards. It's actually substance over form.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think it's substance over form, but I wasn't going to
hold you to it. But thank you for not calling me out on it and allowing me to correct myself. So I think the calls from the community are the least of my concern, because if in fact it's not a scrimmage in substance, then I'm happy to have staff say it's not a scrimmage. You know, you can be upset, but you're not seeing what you think you're seeing. But if in fact it's just a scrimmage by a different name, then I'm not okay with that.
We can't, honestly, we can't promise that somebody isn't trying to pull the wool over our eyes.
And the problem, of course, is how do you monitor this? These games are happening at night.
No, these are not games. These fires.
Well, whatever these are. These activities. I do understand the staff's perspective. How does the staff feel about Michael's suggestion that we contractually make it? Do you think that will create a problem with the renters who then say, forget it, we're not doing it? Or, and then I think, we've discovered you cannot dictate behavior even though, there's rules in place. So I think if you cover yourself, you have an answer to the community should the community walk by and have a problem with what they see.
Well, we
Paderma recommended exactly what Michael said. Paderma said you're not going to be able to enforce it.
Right, yeah. There's no way to enforce it. And let's be honest, any adult men's group are not coming in to do 5 and 5 drills. They're not. So we realize
that. But that's not part of the 60... Is that part of the 61,000?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. And 20 from Winnetka, and then the traditional permanent renters is 41,000.
I think you got to make it clear. I think we'd make it abundantly clear.
Well, we're telling you we're going to make it abundantly clear and they're still going to do it, and you have to be okay with that because we know going in that's what's going to happen.
We're just being really honest
with you.
I'm not presupposing, Lisa. I'm not putting out there that's what... I think there's a risk that happens. But I'm not presupposing that's what the permanent renters are going to do. I don't know.
You go to every playground and there's a big sign that says masks required, and there's, on a nice warm day, there's 70 kids out there running around the playground.
Very true.
We had lots and lots of conversations with our athletic affiliates, soccer and baseball, and we have all driven by an athletic game in Glencoe and felt the hair stand up on the back of our neck within the last 4 months. I think it's naive to say that we're going to bring these folks in here and not think that they're going to immediately try to do what they want to do.
They will. That's what I'm just being honest, because we've seen the behavior throughout
that. That's what Matthew's doing, and everybody knows it. That's kind of what I was trying to say. Like, everyone knows it. It's not like a dirty little secret. Like, they pretty much just do it. These hockey families are going to they're going out of town, they're going to the tournaments. Like, everybody knows that's what hockey's doing. So, I don't think people would be surprised. Our issue is, it's at our facility. The community never understands that it's not the Park District running it, it's our facility, so therefore we are running it and we're responsible. That is going to be the perception. So,
the question is, are we okay being enablers?
When there's hockey time, there's not private skating time at the same time, correct?
There may be on the studio rink, so we may have, practice on the main rink, and we might have open shoot on the studio rink. There may be overlap,
The building is still closed to everybody. We have hockey as well.
Right.
They don't go.
Right. And the soccer field's under construction, so there's not a lot of people on that side of it, except the path, walking path, I think.
At least on a separate rink. Look, if you had a private birthday party, you'd have all sorts of issues with that, too, because people would be close together. You can't control that.
That's why we're not doing private rentals this year, to be honest with you.
That's smart, because you're just going to give yourself props.
Do you want to see potentially what this drill looks like?
Definitely.
Well, I know what it looks like.
Yeah, show it for everybody else, because I don't think they do. That's a good call.
I think one of the, while you're waiting, I think one of the differences between the games, and I struggle with this as well as a parent of a hockey, my kid is wearing a mask all the time on the ice. She is one of three kids on the team during practices. buses that wears a mask literally on the ice the whole time. So I go above and beyond what the requirements are. But I think, you know, one of the reasons why the word game is bad, and it's true, is that once you say there's a game, there's this real big pressure to win, 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 and to keep score, and to just, there's an element of, if you're going to have that pressure to win a game, there's a lot more checking, there's a lot more interaction. That being said, I personally think that hockey has much less interaction than basketball, which we are doing basketball in our facility, but the state's rules are the state's rules, and they're...
Basketball has been changed, so it's a high impact. So we're only doing, we're not doing it like we proposed the other day. We're changing that.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Which we'll update you in the next board meeting. But yeah, we've had to change that also.
Oh,
boy.
It moved to high risk sport.
Makes sense.
You know what? I'm glad, because at least it's consistent, right? I mean, I think more consistency is better.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is this 5-on-5 drill. It's meant to be no contact.
Right, it is less pressure to win, right? So.
The same way you can't stop a soccer game on one of our fields. I mean, you're not renting it out to people, they're just showing up and doing it. So you don't have the control here, you have the control if you want it, but it's not like it's not going to happen. But you're right, the adults that come out there, they're going to play it. If they want to play a hockey game, they're going to play a hockey game. But they're outside, feel better about it that they're outside.
I'm not sure if we have a consensus.
I thought we had a consensus regarding Michael's proposal that aligns with Poderma's recommendation that we put some kind of an amendment or in the contract, and they know what the rules are, with the acknowledgement that we don't have police standing by to monitor whether it's a scrimmage or whatever the heck that thing you just showed, whatever it is. So we're hopeful that people will play by the rules, but I understand that we're not in a position to monitor that, and I do not think if somebody calls up and complains, we could go back to them and say, now you're in breach of your contract or whatever, because of course they'd say we weren't doing that. So I think, you know, at some point it's just, we're just going to hope that people behave themselves, and that's it. Put it in the contract like Michael said.
Does everybody agree with that? Is there a consensus, Dudley?
I guess.
Michael?
Put it in writing.
I like put it in writing. It's what it's a CYA. I like it.
All right, Josh?
I think I'm okay with that. If the contract says you can't scrimmage when the state doesn't allow it, then, you know.
Yeah. We just can't be in a course.
I think we're covered.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, I hope that they won't do that.
Right.
We do too, but I think staff's in agreement.
Very realistic.
For two.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for your feedback on that.
Okay. Other business, Lisa?
There's really nothing. I just put a memo about the Hoover Estate in there, so it's pretty self-explanatory. It's going to be a while till we get to see any money on that, but I just wanted to give you an update on that. So. Really nothing for discussion, just FYI.
Is there anything else?
That's it.
Okay, I entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second.
Roll call vote, please.
Member Boren?
Yes.
Member Covey?
Yes.
Member Ludden?
Yes.
Member Underdog?
Yes.
Chair Brooks?
Yes, motion.
passes. Thank you all for very thoughtful discussion after probably a late night.